solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
One of the things that's interesting about life design is I call it pure design because it's you, your life, and a design process. There's no intermediary of products versus when you're designing products, you're introducing products into that life as an intermediary. And often when you design products, the user is other people. We don't think of ourselves. We think of people who could be very different from us, but we try and solve problems for them. Versus when you're designing your life, this is your opportunity to be very self-centered and to think about you because you're the user of your life. And that's what I remind people, you know, you have one life and the user of that life is you. You need to imagine what's the life that really is your life design that works with your values, that is the kind of life that you that will bring you joy or that will bring you closer to joy.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the 86th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. And this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportspersons, and other leaders in their respective fields to decode insights around three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. In addition to curating this podcast, I work with leaders with a growth mindset as a trusted sounding board, helping them and their organizations transform and play to their unique potential. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Now to the guest of this podcast. It's Aishe Birsel. I was first introduced to her thinking when I had an opportunity to speak with Marshall Goldsmith at the podcast. Some of you might know that he's considered by many as one of the greatest and the most successful coaches of all time. And he spoke about how Aishe had changed his life by getting him to think about his legacy. Then I went and read her book, Design the Life You Love, where she uses the principles of design to help with us architecting the life that we want. Finally, if I reflect on some of the insights I've gathered from the guests over the years and the realization from the advisory work I do, I feel there's a lot of value we can derive by thinking like a designer. Aishe is an accomplished industrial designer, and she's worked with brands like Herman Miller, IKEA, Amazon, and Toyota. She was on the Fast Company's list of most creative people recently, and on the Thinkers 50 radar list of the 30 people that are likely to shape the future of organizations. Her work can also be found in the permanent collection at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Without further ado, let's listen and learn from Aishe Birsel. Aishe, thank you so much for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast. Really excited to have you on the show.
Deepak, thank you. It's great to be here.
And as we were discussing before we started recording, this podcast is about three themes, Aishe. Am I pronouncing your name right, by the way? Aishe, is that right?
You're doing it beautifully.
And all right.
How am I doing?
Yeah, Deepak,
Deepak
is good. It's more P-U-C-K. Deepak is closer to it.
Deepak. Okay.
Yep. That's perfect. Like the Canadian puck.
Deepak. I like it. Thank you.
So, Aishe, this podcast is about three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'd love to sort of dive into the book you've written on the topic, Design Your Life, The Life You Love. But before that, I'm curious about people's journeys and some of the choices they've made in their life. You come from a family of lawyers. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you ended up doing what you're doing now?
Sure. I grew up in a family of lawyers in Turkey, and I thought I was going to study law. But then I realized that I love to create and draw, and that law might not be the best place for that creativity. So then I wanted to become an architect. I didn't want to be an artist because I thought being an artist is too difficult, you know, being alone with that creativity, but that architecture is it's solution making, right? At the service of people. And then after that, from architecture, I turned to design, industrial design, and decided to become an industrial designer.
And when was that transition, the architecture to internal industrial design?
That was actually my last year of high school. So I was planning to attend architecture school. And then a family friend came to tea and said, "Architecture, have you thought about industrial design?" And I had never heard those two words together before. I was like, "Industrial design, what's that?" And he said, "You know, do you see this teacup? We were having tea together." And he said, "You see how the edge is curved? It's so that it fits our lips better. And it has a handle so that we can hold hot liquid in our hands without burning ourselves. And then the saucer is there so that if you spill your tea, you won't ruin your mom's beautiful tablecloth." And he said, "That's industrial design." And in that moment, I fell in love with the human scale of industrial design. And I thought, "Oh, that's what I want to be." And I'm still feeling that. I still love the human scale of industrial design.
Actually, of the various transitions, reinventions you've been through in your life, one of the reinventions that struck me was how you moved from being a designer of things to being a designer of things and being a designer of life. Can you talk a little bit about when you started bringing your attention to the element of life design?
Absolutely. You know, Deepak, sometimes we say something in our life and we don't realize the importance of it. And that happened to me with Design the Life You Love, because I was part of WPO, which is Women Presidents Organization. Mm-hmm. And this is a group of women that we get together to collaborate and to help each other and to learn from each other. And one time we did an exercise where we were asked to define our, I guess it was our mission in one sentence. And I was young and I was kind of bored and I wanted to say something funny that had to do with design. So I said, "My mission is to design the life I love." And I said it in the moment, and I don't know why I said it, but it stuck with me. And then years later, when I developed my own design thinking process, deconstruction, reconstruction, the two things came together. And I thought to myself, "Hey, if I think that our life is our biggest project, and now I have my own process, can I apply this process to my life as kind of like the ultimate test, right?" And that's how it happened.
Wow. And you also talk about that being triggered a little bit by the economic situation at that time, right? One of the themes I'm curious about is how constraints sometimes lead us to creative solutions. So can you throw a little bit of light on the context in which you started focusing on life design as well?
Absolutely. In 2008, when the economy crashed, you know, I had a very successful design studio in New York, but all of our clients, almost all our clients, took their work in-house, and it made total sense for them. They were cutting budgets, and you know, we were on the outside, but I didn't see this coming, and so it was really a very hard 1 year for us where we didn't have any active projects. And that is the time when I, at the urging of one of my dearest friends and collaborators, Leah Kaplan, she said, why don't you use this time, now that you have all this time, to think about how you think, because you think differently. And that was like a lifesaver for me. And I used that year where nobody wanted to work with me to think about how I think. So it was kind of like a deep dive into my head and into my heart and to figure out how I come up with new ideas. And it, the fact that one person valued my thinking made all the difference. And I developed my own design thinking process, deconstruction, reconstruction.
Fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating. And I think if I sort of fast forward to today, the last couple of years, just because of COVID, you know, I come across so many people that have sort of been pushed to a certain corner, but have used that as a springboard to something else, you know, which is fascinating.
Absolutely. I mean, for us as well, COVID changed the way we work. And if I may, I started these weekly virtual Design the Life You Love teas during COVID as a way to help my community and see if they needed anything. Mm-hmm. And we're now up to Design the Life You Love virtual tea number 89, almost at 100. And the amazing thing was this is the thing that helped me through COVID. I thought I was helping people, but it was the other way around. It helped me have a community of amazing people and the chance to meet with them every week, you know?
Lovely.
Things that we would never do, right? If it wasn't for these challenges.
True, true. Diving into the book, Aishe, before we dive into the framework you have, I think the one story that stood out for me, or one example, was of Nelson Mandela. You know, in the book you referred to him and you call him a master designer of life. You know, I've seen a lot of people use a lot of different adjectives on Mandela, but master designer is not one of them. Can you say more about why you think he's a great designer of life?
Absolutely. I think because of the way he reinvented his life again and again, and how he went from a lawyer and a political activist to being a prisoner, and then coming out of prison and going back into politics and then becoming the president of his country. And through it all, I mean, these are major life changes. Mm. And through it all, he seemed to never lose his optimism, his humanity, his empathy for himself and for other people, and how he turned challenges into opportunities. And these are truly the principles of thinking like a designer that I talk about in my book. And I feel like he embodied these, and he never gave up, and he never lost sight of who he was, and he was always at the service of other people. So that's why I thought, you know, his life could have turned in so many different ways, but he redesigned his life again and again, without losing sight of his values. That to me made him a master designer.
I like your choice of words.
In addition to all his other qualities, sorry. No, I'm saying in addition to all his other qualities.
Got it.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. This insight from Aishe reminds me of my conversation with Dr. Ramachandra Guha and his insights around how Gandhiji speaks about his various identities.
I think, of course, there was diet.
Huh?
There was medicine.
and then there was sex or celibacy. So there were these three main obsessions. Well, there was a fourth, which is interfaith harmony, which we've not talked about, which is some ways the most important. What kind of Hindu was he? But we can talk about that later. Now, in terms of his personal idiosyncrasies and eccentricities, he experimented a great deal with that. So it was, what should we eat? What is good? What is bad? What is healthy? What is unhealthy? What excites the senses? What does not excite the senses?
And it seems like a very scientific trial and error kind of
thing. Kind of thing, yeah. Then there was medicine, where he went from being someone who opposed modern medicine to someone who saw a place for it, particularly after he had two surgeries that saved his life, one for pines and one for appendicitis. So he adopted a more plural, pragmatic approach to medicine. And then there was celibacy, which is the most peculiar and bizarre thing, where he was so obsessed with celibacy that he conducted this strange and notorious experiment of testing it by sleeping with his grandniece, which I described.
Just before, the year before independence.
Yeah, right? Which I described in a chapter of my book. And that came from some peculiar belief that if you are sexually pure, you can control society and tame the passions. That if you tame the passions within you, you can tame the passions outside. Hindus and Muslims are seeing each other. Totally observed, and also I say a manifestation of vanity. That if he is sexually poor, Indians will stop fighting among each other. Right. So then there is, in terms of his inner journey, his religious journey, which is very interesting and very novel and worth spending time on and rediscovering. So Gandhi was a Hindu, and he even called himself Sanatani Hindu, but he was a very special kind of Hindu. For one thing, his Hinduism did not require a shrine to express itself. So in adult life, he went to a temple only once, which is the Madurai temple in Meenakshi, because they had finally admitted Dalits. The kingdom of God was within him, Ram was in his heart. That's the first aspect of Hinduism. Faith is within you. It's inside. You don't need a church or a mosque or a temple.
The other piece that stood out for me in my conversation with Dr. Guha is the point he makes about the fluidity of how Gandhiji thought about his identity. He didn't quite confine himself to any one particular box.
So I think it's best to read out just three paragraphs in my book to explain how Gandhi himself saw his multiple callings.
Uh-huh.
So here I'm reading out Gandhi. Mm-hmm. It is what I say about Gandhi, and then there's a quote of Gandhi in between.
Sure.
To deliver India from British rule was by no means Gandhi's only preoccupation. The forging of harmonious relations between India's often disputatious religious communities was the second. The desire to end the pernicious practice of untouchability in his own Hindu faith was a third. And the impulse to develop economic self-reliance for India and moral self-reliance for Indians was a fourth. These campaigns were conducted by Gandhi in parallel. All were to him of equal importance. In 1933, he wrote to a close friend that, quote, "My life is one indivisible whole. My life is one indivisible whole. I cannot devote myself entirely to untouchability and say, neglect Hindu-Muslim unity or Swaraj. All these things run into one another and are interdependent. You will find that one time in my life, an emphasis on one thing, at another time on another. But that is just like a pianist, now emphasizing one note and now another. But they are all related to one another." End of quote. And this is what I say in the end. For Gandhi, political independence meant nothing at all unless it was accompanied by religious harmony, caste and gender equality, and the development of self-respect in every Indian. Other patriots had used the Hindi word Swaraj to signify national independence. Gandhi made Indians aware of its true or original meaning, Swaraj or self-rule.
Fascinating.
So that is Gandhi in his own words. And that's also why, as I told you a little while ago, I don't believe in saying this is the most important thing, this is the only cause, this is the one route to success. You know, Gandhi conducted these multiple careers and saw them of equal importance. And at different times, different aspects of his work came into the forefront, others receded, then those came into the forefront, and so on.
Three things stand out for me from my conversation with Dr. Guha. One, Gandhiji had a really scientific approach to life and conducted many experiments. Second, He was not really fixated about his beliefs and was willing to evolve them depending on his experiments. And third, he didn't quite box himself by any single identity. He was fluid about who he was being at various points in time. If this topic is of interest, you might also like my conversation with Vinay Sitapati at the podcast, where he speaks about Narasimha Rao. That conversation is a masterclass on leadership under constraints. You can visit playtopotential.com and look for Vinay Sitapati in the guest section. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Ayshe Birsel. Now, I was just listening to your careful choice of words. You know, in the book, you say in life, there's no design, there's only redesign. Seems like a simple statement, but I'm sure there's a depth of wisdom behind it. Just unpack it for us.
Sure. Actually, that was something that I learned from a dear friend of mine, Ralph Kaplan, who is an amazing, well, he was an amazing author. And his book, By Design, is probably one of the seminal books in and about design. So I was very lucky because Ralph Kaplan was my friend and my mentor. And when I told him about Design the Life You Love, this new thing that I was doing, he said, Ayshe, you know, in life, there is no design. It's all redesign. And I thought, you know, you're right, because I mean, it was really presumptuous of me to assume that you've never designed your life until I show up. I think we're constantly designing and redesigning our lives. And all that I am doing is offering my process and set of tools and saying, hey, I find these things, you know, this process to be useful. They help me design products. I think they'll help you design your life. That was a good learning moment for me.
Hmm. So let's talk about your process, Ayshe. You talk about a bowl of soup, interestingly enough, and you talk about how we can, you have a four-step process that you suggest. Can you walk us through what these are and maybe elaborate a little bit just for the listeners to get a sense of the crux of thinking?
Sure. So my process is deconstruction, reconstruction, and it has four steps. And I thought I need an easy way to explain it to people that doesn't come from design. So chicken soup or soup was a good example. So let's imagine if you want to make soup, you think of the ingredients that go into a soup, right? And those things could be, you know, onions and chicken stock, let's say, and some rice, some tomatoes. And as you're thinking of the ingredients, what you're doing and what I'm doing with you right now is I'm deconstructing the soup. And I could say also, well, is this a soup that is like the kind of soup that my Turkish grandma would make? Or is this the kind of soup that your grandma would make? You know, it's like two different cultures, the same soup. Mm. But, you know, maybe in Turkey we put rice and in India you put something else, you know. Mm. So anyways, it's really like looking at what's something made up of is the first step. And then the second step is how can we think about this from a different perspective? How could we see the same things from a different light? And so if you teach me how to make chicken soup like your grandmother made, that's going to shift my thinking about chicken soup. And I could, based on that, say, you know what, maybe this should be a vegetarian soup. And so I'll take chicken stock out and instead replace that with vegetable stock. And now I've started playing with the ingredients, the parts, right? And then maybe, you know, some other people will tell us, hey, now that you've taken you've taken chicken stock out and you're making this with vegetable stock, well, how are we going to eat this? What if what if instead of a hot soup, we thought about that, about this as cold soup? And so now we could reconstruct it, put it back together, and we leave some things out. We could leave the temperature, the hot temperature out of it, and then introduce the idea of cold temperature. Now we're like thinking about how we put the ingredients back together in a whole new way. And then in doing that, how do we express it, which is the fourth step? And the expression could be, hey, if you're going to make this cold soup, have you thought about what if we freeze it? You know, it's a whole other way of, you know, it's taking the cold idea and expressing it in a whole different way. If we can freeze it, then maybe we could make, you know, a new kind of soup that's frozen and yet edible. You know, maybe it's a popsicle soup. And now, you know, we've come up with a whole different way. We've deconstructed soup. We thought about the same elements differently. As we thought about them differently, we did some research and brought new culture into it. And then that led us to reconstructing it in a way that's new and different. And that new reconstruction that then allowed us to express it as a new idea. And then if we were commercializing this, we could say, hey, this is a popsicle soup that you can eat on the way to, you know, on the way to school or on the way to work. You don't you don't need a bowl for it. And so that's how I think. And that's how I think with our clients, you know, with Target or Herman Miller, with Toyota. And I teach them this so that we can now deconstruct and reconstruct together, and they can think differently about the same things that they know, that they're experts on. And then I teach the same thing to people about their life.
And just to bring it to life, Aishe, do you want to illustrate these four maybe in the context of a life design situation? Just for us, for the listeners to appreciate how this transfers to a life context?
Absolutely. I mean, our life is our biggest project. And when we say life, it's a big topic. So what I want people to do is to break that into its parts and say, hey, what are the parts and pieces of my life? You know, there's maybe family in there, there's work in there, there's friends, there's health, there are hobbies, and then there's how I use time. And then all of those things could be broken into their separate parts. And as we do that, as we deconstruct our life, we start to realize that there are parts that have different weights, and some of those parts, now that they're deconstructed, we can change them, we can replace them, or we can make new combinations. And then as we do that, we start to see the same things differently about our life. And as we start to see them differently, I introduced the idea of inspiration, because when you're creating something, you need inspiration. And in our life, inspiration is other people. So I call them our heroes. And in getting people to think about their heroes, I help them reconnect with their own values. And then once you're reconnected with your values, and you realize what's important to you, then you can make choices based on your values, which is a big part of designing something. Mm-hmm. And then based on those values, you reconstruct. And in reconstructing, you can think about your life and try and play with different ideas and say, hey, if I... Reconstruction is also Deepak understanding that you can't have everything, and that's the beauty of design. And so you have to think about different permutations of ideas and say, what if I have these three things versus those three things, and combine different ideas. And then from that, once you have a reconstruction that excites you, you can go to how to express your life.
Got it.
Does that answer your question? It's Indeed. Really, I guess, my goal is to help people think about their life as something that they can, instead of letting life come at you, mm-hmm. it's really designing your life is saying, well, I can envision my life using design tools and practice. Mm-hmm. And based on those ideas, I can now bring that idea to life, just like a designer would bring a chair or a car to life. Hmm. I want people to have an idea, a creative idea about what's important to them, and think about that ahead of time, visualize it, imagine it. And then once they do that, they get excited. And then that excitement propels them towards making that idea happen. And then I also tell them, well, how do you make that idea happen? You do it by creating a list of to-dos, getting collaborators involved, enlisting people in your idea, which all those things come from design. Everything that I know, my expertise is in design. I just show how design and life overlap and get people to think.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I love the point Aishe makes about how we sometimes struggle to figure out what really matters to us. Thinking about who our heroes are sometimes can sharpen our self-awareness around what really matters to us and what we care about. Something similar came up in my conversation with Rama Bijapurkar, a board member and an expert in the area of consumer insight.
And so I have a friend who said to me that why don't you figure out three role models of people who you really respect. And my list of three was C.K. Prahlad, Chidambaram, and Bhimsen Joshi. Okay, I knew two of them, C.K. and Chidambaram, pretty well. I didn't know Bhimsen at all. But I then realized that all three of them were absolutely solo performers. I mean, C.K., who is my teacher and my guru in every way, actually sat in wherever his office in Michigan, Ann Arbor, and gave the whole world, not just the theory of core competence, the idea of competing for the future, the idea of fortune at the bottom of the pyramid. I mean, the man just did it repeatedly again and again and again. The idea of co-opting your consumers, the whole set of things. And then when you looked at Chidambaram, he was when he wasn't being the minister and he was out of power, he was just a damn good lawyer. And when he was stopped being a lawyer, he was a minister. But he was pretty much because of his individual stuff. And I went to Bhimsen's 70th birthday at that time, or 60, 70, and he said that, and he sang for himself. And he basically said that day from the podium that I've said to the Lord that the day I stop singing, please take me away. Once I had those three, and you know, and it's again serendipity. How did the three come? I don't know, you know. And,
but the takeaway from each of their lives.
But so then I said, here are guys who don't really have any umbrellas, platforms, nothing. But they've basically given the world what they've given the world.
If we feel stuck around the question, what do I want out of life? Shining the light on the people that we instinctively look up to might have cues that could help us move forward and architect a life that's fit for purpose for our context. If you like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever else you consume this content. I discovered that Spotify has recently launched the ratings button. So if you happen to consume the content on Spotify, do take a moment to review the show. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Aishe Birsel. And given you do both, Aishe, you know, Can you sort of throw the light on what are the, let's say, nuances in, let's say, life design versus product design, you know, in addition to whatever is applicable from product design? Are there any elements which start becoming significant when we embark on life design?
Oh, I love that question. Thank you for asking that. It's one of the things that's interesting about life design is I call it pure design because it's you, your life, and the design process. There's no intermediary of products. Versus when you're designing products, you're introducing products into that life as an intermediary. And often when you design products, the user is other people. Like we don't think of ourselves. We think of people who could be very different from us, but we try and solve problems for them. Versus when you're designing your life, this is your opportunity to be very self-centered and to think about you because you're the user of your life. And that's what I remind people, you know, you have one life and the user of that life is you. You need to imagine what's the life that really is your life design that works with your values, that is the kind of life that you that will bring you joy or that will bring you closer to joy. And then, of course, we're not alone in this life, right? But once you have that idea, you can bring other people into it. So you can bring your family into it as your collaborators and talk to your spouse or children or your parents about, here's my vision for my life. I need your help. Let's collaborate on it together. And you bring other people in.
That's interesting.
But first, you need to know what you want.
Even there, if I go back to one of the things I learned from another individual, a lady called Tasha Urich, who was on this podcast many moons back, she talks about the notion of internal self-awareness and external self-awareness. And she says, one is our internal understanding of our needs, wants, aspirations, and so on. And sometimes when we get external input, it sort of comes in our blind spot. And it's important to address both before we, you know, form a full picture. Any thoughts on the outside-in perspective, even at the design stage?
Oh, I like Tasha's work a lot. So, and thank you for reminding us of that. I think it's, both are really important. So the way I try and approach it is, I want to connect people with their superpowers and their kryptonite and their values as internal drivers, and then get them to think about their challenges and opportunities and the things that they want to include versus the things that they want to avoid. And so there is that tension, a very healthy tension between who they are on the inside, and then what's their environment and how they can create a balance between the two.
Got it. And one of the things you talk about, Aisha, is in your book, you suggest that we warm up our right brain before we embark on the exercises. You actually ask us to draw something for 5 minutes. You know, I'm trained as my left brain has gone through a lot of training, given I trained as an engineer and I went to B school. But can you throw a little bit of light on how we can sort of warm up our right brain before we embark on some of these exercises that you suggest?
Yes, I think it's kind of going back to your childhood, right? When we were 3 or 4 or 5, we, all of us, drew things and played with crayons, and there was that playfulness in what we were doing. And so I think it's a capability that we all have, but that depending on our education that we forget. So I want to bring that back to people and say, before you do anything creative, and you don't have to be a designer to be creative, we can all use creative problem solving. Before we get into that space, we need to warm up our creative brain. And it's very similar to what we would do when we go to a gym and we warm up our muscles. So the idea of drawing something is really that same idea of warming up, but in this case, our right brains. And then that centers us and gives a signal to our brains that we're entering the creative space. And we're going to think differently and creatively. And I think it's essential. So I try to get people to do that when I work with them. And it does make a difference. It kind of centers them and they give themselves permission to be more creative. Now, the thing that makes drawing difficult for us, I think, is because we judge ourselves and we think, well, if we draw, it has to be a masterpiece. Mm. And nothing can be further than the truth. It's drawing is a language, and we all use that language. You know, we can talk in metaphors and be very visual, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can write and we can do math formulas. So it's just one more language and that we've learned as children. And we've somehow forgotten. And I just bring that back.
And just like maybe you're staying with it, just like drawing something for 5 minutes as a warm up. Are there 2-3 other things that you do just out of curiosity, just to sort of get people into a creative frame of mind?
Yes. I ask them about their emotions. And this is something that I learned way back when, similar to your question, we were thinking about, like, how could we help people be in this moment together with us? And I learned that asking people about how they feel right now is very helpful because it suddenly connects them. We call it the elevator from your brain to your heart. And suddenly you connect with your mood in this moment, and it gives people a chance to recognize, hey, I might have been doing something else, like before I came here. Like, I don't know what you were doing before you and I started, you know, talking together. I was doing email. What were you doing?
No, it's 5 a.m. For me, it was just wake up and get ready for a cup of coffee and get ready for the conversation.
Exactly. So if I ask you, like, Deepak, how are you feeling right now?
I'd say energized. Energized is a word that comes to mind. Just an opportunity to listen to somebody in a different part of the world who has a very different perspective on life than the ones I've been exposed to. So just at this point of time, soaking in the wisdom and energized.
Great. And I feel very focused right now to make sure that I can be as clear in this moment as I can be to articulate my thoughts. So just saying that, did it make you kind of connect with yourself for a second?
And it's interesting, Aisha. I think it's sort of, in a way, back to the point around being present in the moment and being cognizant of how you are showing up. I think it sort of, I felt, brought back my attention to, you know, how I'm showing up in this conversation. So
great.
And it's also one of those things that we don't, as you rightly say, we don't give words to. It's sort of one of those things that just remains, but giving language to it and precipitating it, I'm guessing, has its own power in unlocking creativity.
Yes, and so now imagine I go one step further and I ask people, not only to kind of say how they're feeling in this moment, I also say, do a quick drawing of how you're feeling. And then people draw emojis or, you know, sometimes they get very creative and they do these wonderful drawings, but even a smiley face can suffice, right? And that, just that can serve as your warm up for creative thinking. And that's it. Now you're connected with your heart and you've, you know, done some sketching, and that it's really interesting how small adjustments like that can help you think differently or be more open to the process.
And the other piece I was curious about, Aishe, was the elapsed time, right? You talk about the four-step process. This is also one of those things, right, which is not an overnight exercise, but it requires us to immerse in some of these things over a period of time, sleep over it, and, you know, get to a meaningful place. But in your observation, what have you observed about the time it takes to a meaningful redesign, these four steps? Is it weeks? Is it months? Is it days? Any perspectives here?
You know, what's been really interesting, because I've been doing this for now more than 10 years, helping people design their life. And I've done all kinds of kind of slices of time. So I've done it in an hour at conferences like the Fast Company Innovation Conference. I've done it over 1 week at a retreat. I've done it over 7 weeks with my students at the School of Visual Arts. So the timing, I just did it yesterday in 2 hours using our new digital tool, Design the X You Love, as an online tool. So it really changes. And the thing that I try to do is, I really believe that what's the most difficult thing and the most important thing is to start. Once you start, once you start a design, the rest is easy, because you get hooked in the process of developing new ideas. But starting that first, you know, like kind of that white page, right, is what's so difficult. So my goal these days, whether it's with the book or the online tool that I just mentioned, is to find ways to get people into that state quickly and accelerate that process. And so in the with the online tool, for example, I get people in 40 minutes from the beginning to writing their manifesto about their life, or a subset of their life, and in 20 minutes from a manifesto to an action plan. And once you do that, you have something tangible that you can sleep on and think about and develop. So that's become my kind of a shortcut. And I was listening to a podcast about shortcuts, and I learned that shortcuts is when an expert does a lot of thinking so that other people don't have to think about it and really can take the quick route. So I feel like I've created a shortcut to design the life you love.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. This reminds me of a conversation I had with Herminia Ibarra of London Business School. She's the author of the book Working Identity, and is one of the leading thinkers in the space of leadership and career transitions. How do you see the spectrum of the time it takes for senior leaders, let's say successful leaders in the mid-40s, to move from, let's say, context A to context B? Is it 6 months, 12 months? Do you have a...
3 years. It's still 3 years. It's, I mean, I ask people all the time, you know, we have people here who are in a program that's a one-year program, and they're hoping that will do the trick, and it never does. And it's very frustrating, because, and honestly, you know, part of it is,
where does it start? When does the time frame actually start? Because there's also the bit of getting yourself to the point where sure. you can start walking. And, sure. And so it's often a longer chunk than you think. But it's if you think about extricating yourself, getting yourself to the point where you're actively looking for something else, mm-hmm. and then the looking, and then the finding the, just exactly the right. And if you've taken time off in between and you're taking on back to school in between, it can easily be 3 years.
True.
And it's because people are not going to hire you unless you have the experience. It's because you don't have the network into that yet. You don't even have the language. You're still sorting it out for yourself. Experiment and learn takes a little bit longer. And that's the hard part for people, but that's often why they also go portfolio. They start consulting on some of the old stuff just to make sure some money's coming in because you've got to continue life.
I guess there's no silver bullet here, but it's critical to note that transitions are not an instantaneous switch, but an organic process that takes time. Creating space for that possibility to emerge and being deliberate about it are critical. I find that given the busy lives people lead, taking a pause and creating the space is often the biggest barrier coming in the way of people being able to redesign their lives. Let's now get back to the conversation with Aisha Birsell. I didn't realize there was a podcast about shortcuts. I need to look it up.
I think it's on Freakonomics.
Interesting.
I can send it to you.
Sure. You actually have a provocative line in the book, Aisha, as I was reading it. You say that, you know, at one point you say, if you have a perfect life, just stop here and go no further. You know, you say you once you deconstruct your life, you will never be able to put it back quite the same way, almost like you use the example of a camera to make the point. Now, what's the watch out here? You know, who should not be over, you know, there's something to be said about overthinking it or oversweating it when things are broadly okay. So any thoughts on, watching out for this?
Yes, that's my disclaimer. And I do tell people, one thing about design is once you start designing, and especially once you start deconstructing something, you're not going to think about it the same way again. And I thought, you know, there's a responsibility to getting people to deconstruct their lives. What if they have a great life? Maybe they don't need to redesign it, you know? And I have a similar approach with design when I'm designing products. I feel like if there's a great product out there, maybe the best thing to do is not to design it, you know, and let it be. So similarly, I tell people, once you start deconstructing your life, it's not going to go back the way it was before. So if you have the perfect life, don't touch it, you know, and leave now. And it's the camera analogy there is, that you mentioned is kind of like taking a camera that works well. And then if you were to break it apart, you'll realize, oh my, you know, this has hundreds of pieces that make it up, right? And then it's really hard to put it back the way it was. And our life is kind of similar. You know, we say life and it's just one word. But when once we deconstruct it, we realize they're like, lots of things that go into this life. And as you see that, you start thinking differently. You might come to a very different expression. So that's why I thought it's important to tell people, like, if you have a good life, maybe this is not the right time to redesign it. If I may add to it, it's also, I think I see design as problem solving. And so you need a problem to solve. If you don't have a problem to solve, then you don't need to design.
As I was reading the statement, the question in my head was, you know, what question should I ask myself to see if I have a perfect life, right? It begs the question, you know, what are the markers of a good life or a perfect life, whatever we use, to for us to get a rough sense of, you know, is it worth embarking on this? Is it worth rocking the boat, if I may put it that way?
Yes. Well, one thing that I've been doing more and more is to show people that life is also made up of smaller pieces, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe you don't want to design your whole life, but you could say, hey, I want to design the, let's say, the vacation I love, or I want to design the legacy I love. I want to design the love life I love. So you can, the more I do it, the more I realize the subsets could be really worthwhile as design projects.
Interesting. Aishi, moving forward, you say that when we are in a creative process, you know, there are situations where we get an idea, but we can't quite put a finger on what the idea is. And in those situations, you say that metaphors sometimes help us and help us get our thoughts across. Can you say more here? I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I love metaphors as a design tool because metaphors help us understand new or different things in relation to things we know. So, for example, the soup example we talked about is a metaphor, like making soup is a metaphor for designing your life. So what I do in my sessions is to ask people to come up with a life metaphor, and then using the metaphor, using the hooks inside the metaphor to think about their life differently. So the example I want to give you is actually the metaphor I've been using throughout COVID is metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. So I ask people, you know, COVID, our life through COVID is kind of like metamorphosis. And what is metamorphosis? It's the process of a worm becoming a butterfly, right? And so, well, not a worm, it's a
caterpillar.
Now, caterpillar, thank you. So I'll start that again. The process of metamorphosis is a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. So, and in the middle of that, you have the cocoon, right? And so once COVID started and we started sheltering in place, to me, that was like us sitting like caterpillars inside our cocoons and everything we know breaking apart, including ourselves. And then I thought, well, before we were caterpillars, through COVID, we've been in our homes, going through an incredible change. And when we come out, we're not going to come out the way we were. We're going to come out as butterflies. And then when we come out as butterflies, that's really understanding that we're now a whole different insect and we have wings and we can fly. And using that metaphor, I got people to think about who were they before and what they want to keep from before COVID. And then what are the things that they've learned through COVID and the things that changed and then that transformation that happened to them. And then going forward, what are the things that they want to keep and the things they want to change, including their new wings? You know, what's going to help them fly and take off? And so I hope I just demonstrated the incredible power of metaphors in helping us think differently.
Absolutely. I think it's also been a great learning journey for me over the last several months in the context of the podcast, just to hear how different people, you know, look at COVID through their own unique lens. You know, one of the people I spoke to was a monk who's now at MIT, a gentleman called Tenzin Priyadarshi. And he said COVID is like a giant, is like a massive timeout that Mother Nature has given men and women to sort of, you know, you stay in your homes and sort out your stuff. You know, almost like how we would tell our kids to stay in a room and sort out their thinking and cool down and sort of get on with life. And the, you know, the way he framed it was just so simple yet so powerful. Similarly, this notion of a caterpillar and a butterfly is powerful. And the metaphor of a cocoon in the context of COVID. Thanks for sharing.
Ah, thank you. So that's why I love metaphors. And for your listeners, one of my friends, Todd Churches, actually has written a beautiful book. It's called Visual Leadership. And it's one word, visual leadership. And he also talks a lot about metaphors from the angle of leadership. So the two, our thoughts are very complementary.
You know, one of the other people, you know, maybe staying with the point about metaphors, one of my earlier guests was a gentleman called Dan Cable of the London Business School. And he actually said when they have people in their workshops, they ask them to imagine different possible selves in the future. And they give them a few Lego blocks and ask them to build something with Lego. And use that as an opportunity to, you know, give voice to what's inside them. So I can very well imagine the power of, you know, the right brain and metaphors and some of these surrogates to unlock what's inside us.
Oh, I love that. The idea of working with metaphors and Legos. Wow, that's powerful. You're making me think, one of the things I say in the book and I ask people to do is to write their metaphor and also to draw it. And what's interesting is the two things are quite different and yet they complete each other. So as we're drawing, we think of different things. And then when we're writing, we're thinking about different things. And so it now is 1 + 1 = 3, a much more complete idea.
Actually, that leads me to the next question, Aishe. You say that a great expression is more than the sum of the parts, right? Can you say more about this here? Can you bring this to life for us?
Yeah, I, as a designer, I'm really a student of the idea of less is more. So I'm constantly trying to come up with how can we, using less parts, make more. And so that notion of 1 + 1 = 3, how can we create value by combining two ideas that maybe are difficult to put together, but then if you can, offer more more value. So that notion of dichotomy resolution is something that I really believe in and practice.
One of the things that's top of mind for me, I have two young kids, a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old. You know, I'm curious about how to imbibe some of these things in kids, right? In a way, at least we grew up in a time where things were relatively linear, but I realize their kids are growing into a future which is going to require them to be a lot more deliberate about how they design and redesign as they go through life. What's some of your thinking around how we can start helping our kids appreciate some of these things and sort of to give them the foundation as they grow up?
Absolutely. I mean, what you just said is something that I think about often. And I think you and I, even though we grew up in different places, you know, we grew up with a similar, like you said, a linear roadmap. You do this, you go to school, you study hard, you know, you go to work, you work hard, you meet someone, you get married, you have kids. It was very like tutum, tutum, tutum. You do this and then you do that. And I find my kids are also teenagers. They're 17 and 18. And I feel like there are no, I can't give them the same roadmap. You know, there are no roadmaps today because everything is fluid and changeable and uncertain, and which is an incredible challenge. But at the same time, that's the opportunity, right? There are no roadmaps, so create your own roadmap. And in a way, design the life you love is my answer to that. Teaching kids to think like a designer with optimism and empathy and collaboration and an open mind, asking what if questions and seeing the big picture and connecting the dots in new and different ways early on, and making that a lifelong practice. So that's the only way I know how to do it. And yeah.
As a coach, one of the things I think about is the gap between cognitively or getting something in our mind versus living it. I was curious about your thinking around, you know, what it takes from designing the life to living the life. Any insights there in the way that plays out, and also sort of the iterative nature of the two?
Absolutely. You're so right in, like, how do you go from idea to actually living it? I think that often the idea happens inside us, right? In our own brains. We're alone when we're creating the idea. And then to live it, we have to do it collectively. So we're together. And this is true for the design process, and as well as like design of products and designing your life. When I'm designing something, I'm sitting in my chair at home, listening to music and working in my sketchbook. But then once I have the beginnings of a good idea, something that I feel like answers the criteria or turns the challenges into opportunities in a certain way, something that excites me, that's when I take it to my client and I share it with them early on. And then we start working on it together. And I feel the process with life design is very similar. You have an idea, you have an insight, you have something that excites you. And then that excitement is what propels you towards the future. And you realize, but to bring this idea to life, I need collaborators, I need help, I need to do this, I need to kind of try it out. And you make a little prototype, you test it with other people, you bring them in, you build it together, you create it together, and then you you test it, you realize this part doesn't work, and then you replace that, and it's iterative like that. And one of my favorite examples of this is Marshall Goldsmith, who's known as the world's number one leadership coach, who works with the best CEOs in the world. He came to one of my sessions, and when I was asking everybody to design his life, he came up with this idea based on his heroes, to create something where he could teach everything he knows to other people without asking for anything in return. And from that simple idea of, I want to teach everything I know to others, he created the idea of 15, initially it was called 15 coaches. He said, I want to teach everything I know to 15 coaches. And he put this on LinkedIn as an idea. And he said, I'm giving away my knowledge. Who'd like to learn from me? And then he thought maybe 100 people or 1,000 people would reply. And 17,000 people replied.
Wow.
And from that, the idea of Marshall Goldsmith 100 coaches was born. It grew from 15 to 100. And now it's more than 100 people. And the idea is Marshall teaches his expertise and his knowledge to us. And I'm part of Marshall Goldsmith 100 coaches. And then the only thing we need to do is, when it's our time to teach what we know to others for free. And so it's this idea of a knowledge philanthropy. So anyways.
Fascinating. In a way, that's what
long answer, but you know, Marshall had the idea, and then once he had the idea, he, by putting it on LinkedIn, he opened it up to collaboration. And then from that, it became something that that was real.
And it's also interesting that you played a role in sort of opening up that possibility. Now you're playing your role in as a disseminator of that possibility as a part of MG100. Even this conversation, I guess in a way you're sort of, this is knowledge philanthropy, right? I sincerely appreciate you doing it.
Oh, I love how you connected the dots there. Thank you so much, Deepak. Truly, it was, and you're right. You know, it's funny because with Marshall, he says, Aisha changed my life because I came up with this idea in her session. And I tell Marshall, hold on 1 second, you changed my life. And so it's kind of like a circle of giving, really.
Fascinating. Marshall was on this podcast as well a few moons back. And he spoke about you on that podcast as well. So clearly, you know, clearly made a big difference to him. And all of us are beneficiaries of his and your philanthropy. So, Aisha.
And yours.
Thank you. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. We had a chance to speak to Marshall Goldsmith on the podcast earlier.
I met a great woman named Aisha Bursell, who's a designer. And she said, who are your heroes? Well, my heroes, back to my story, were these kind and generous people who are great teachers. Paul Hersey and Peter Drucker and Frances herself and Alan Mulally and all these iconic people, Warren Bennis. And she said, why don't you be like them? And I said, that's a nice idea. I decided to adopt 15 people, teach them all I know for free. And the only price is when they get old, they have to do the same thing. So I made a little selfie video and put it on LinkedIn. So I have 1.3 million followers on LinkedIn. And I thought 100 people would apply. I'd adopt 15 young people. They would follow me around. I would tell stupid jokes. They'd laugh, make me feel good. And then they'd get old and do the same thing. You know, cycle of life. I was wrong. Over 18,000 people applied.
Wow.
And over 280 have been adopted. And so now this program kind of changed my life.
If this topic is of interest, you might also like to tune into my conversation with Herminia Ibarra, where she speaks about designing micro experiments. She says that we have to act our way into a new way of thinking, not think our way into a new way of acting. Let's now get back to Aisha and wrap up the conversation. As we wrap up, Aisha, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. As you think of this phrase, what comes top of mind to you?
You know, when you reached out to me, I love that about your title because I think play is so important, especially when we're thinking about serious things. Levity is required, and that's right there in your title. And I think play is important because when we're playing, we're like kids, we're not afraid of making mistakes. And if we can play, then we can connect with our potential. So I think you're really onto something here.
Aisha, real delight having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being so generous and so so present and so light and so kind in this conversation. Thank you.
Deepak, thank you. You brought me joy. This was a wonderful conversation. I felt really honored to be here with you, to be here with you and your audience. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of messages before we wrap up. Do take a moment and rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. I noticed that Spotify also recently introduced a feature where regular listeners can rate a show. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a huge difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise out there, given the boom in the supply in podcasts in India and around the world in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers who look at some of these metrics. If you're interested in receiving short 2 minutes extracts of wisdom from the podcast served up once a week, consider signing up by sending a WhatsApp message at +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Here we share short extracts across the various guests and insights we've gleaned at the podcast over the last 5 years. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Thank you, and hope to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.